Okay, so you know the score, right? It's not going to be that different from E&M. The kind of the main difference is, at least currently, I'm not going to do the overhead projector stuff. The reviews were kind of yes, no. The thing that people liked the best about that was to have some sort of PDF hard copy that they could review and find maybe mistakes in their notes. So I'll try and do that. I'll try and write a review sheet for the lecture and post it on the website so that so maybe the most useful thing will be there. And if you guys decide you want to switch, it's not a big deal. This thing is probably of almost zero value, but it's also pretty much of almost zero difficulty. So I think I'll probably continue to do that. Like I say, if any of you find it useful, you might tell me, because I'm figuring no one's finding it useful. But it is pretty easy to do. So kind of the usual, those are the websites. Your textbook is there. There'll be a big file of assignments. There are three problems there already for next time. My idea is, you know, kind of as usual, that the problems are going to be moderately difficult and you're going to have questions. You're going to come to my office and ask me those questions. You're not going to sit for a half an hour with a blank sheet of paper in front of you. That's a waste of time. If you can't make progress in 5 or 10 minutes, you should probably knock on somebody's door. The exam dates are there. And they can be moved just like they could in E&M. Any questions? Well, so in an hour, I'll be standing in front of a huge 106 class, and the topic is going to be sound. And the question I'm going to ask them is, what's waving? Yeah, so you guys don't have any problem with this, right? Pressure. There are lots of other things that are waving too, like density and temperature. Now, we're studying quantum mechanics, and earlier on, kind of the original version of quantum mechanics was called wave mechanics, Schrodinger's wave mechanics, in contrast to Heisenberg's matrix mechanics. So, what's waving? What are these waves? Those are the sort of answers I'll get from the 106ers. Which I take it mean I don't have any idea what's waving.
Probability of
their location. Yeah, that's not bad. So what's going to be waving is the square root of the probability density. And, okay, so that probably means about as much as pressure does to the 106ers. What is probability density? So if we think about a simple mechanical system, and that's pretty much what we'll be dealing with, very simple mechanical systems to start with. If I put this ball on this ramp and I release it and I ask where it is after a second, what you learned in mechanics is that if I released it with exactly the same position and velocity, and again, ask where it is at 1 second, it's going to be at exactly the same spot. But it's not true. So it turns out, according to quantum mechanics, that if we do this experiment, we will not find the particles all in one spot. We do it the first time, we might find it at 6.21 centimeters. We do it again, we might find it at 6.99 centimeters. We find a whole long list of possibly variable spots where this particle would end up at a particular time. And so kind of the first question is, what's the relationship between that list of experiments, results of experiments, and this probability density. Some are going to show up more often than others. And kind of where the probability density is big, it's where they're going to be kind of mostly show up, and where it's small, you're not going to see much. And I think what you would expect is if I made a plot of this probability density, let me call it rho, you know, it would be, you know, some sort of blob like that. It would have some average value, it would have some width, and we could specify those by standard deviation and mean. And it doesn't have to have a really nice bell-shaped curve, right? There's no reason it couldn't look, you know, in a really funny fashion. But very frequently in our homework problems, we will assume a nice Gaussian shape just because it's a relatively easy formula to deal with. Okay, well, I come back to my question, though. How do I go from that list of numbers to that kind of bell-shaped curve? Plot. Plot what, right? So I have a thousand values of locations, as you will in the homework problems. How do I go to that plot of probability density? Computer. Spreadsheet. Yeah, those are all good words. Well, let's start with this idea of density. So if you wanted to find the density of a whale, how would you do that? Yeah, but that would be what you'd call the bulk density, right? So the density of a whale is different at different spots. And you'd cut up into little pieces, and you take one of these little pieces, and you take the mass that's in that piece, and you divide it by the volume. And maybe I should put little deltas there, because I am talking about small pieces. So this is probability density. So what I want to do is to divide up the possible list of locations into some pieces, and I want to calculate the probability that it's in one of these spots. So how would I calculate that, the probability that it's in one of those bins, given a list of 1,000 numbers? So how do I do all of the amount?
You take integral.
No, so all I have is a list of numbers.
Got it.
And I'm trying to get that plot, not the other way around.
You fit to something.
Yeah, I don't know that. So if you had a coin and you were trying to see whether it was a true coin or not, and you had a list of 1,000 heads and tails, how would you figure out the probability that it's heads? Yeah, and then you take the ratio to the total. So how many of these numbers are in the range that we specify? We can count them, right? So we can then take that little bit of numbers and divide it by n, and that's going to be the probability that it's in that range. And then we're going to want to divide this by the size of the range, and that's what I'm going to mean by the probability density. Okay. So what are the units of probability density?
Per length,
right? Per meter, right? Yeah, whatever it is. these ends are certainly unitless, but even if they weren't unitless, the units would cancel and we'd still have per length. And so this quantity, which we're going to call the wave function psi, it's going to have units of per square root of length. Okay, so if this is the probability density, what does the square root of the probability density look like? Say again?
What is the one?
So if this is the curve that is the probability density, what does the curve of the square root of the probability density look like? A lot like that, right? Square root of big numbers are big, square root of small numbers are small, not exactly like that. Okay, well, so, you know, something like that. So I come back, what's waving? I don't see anything waving. I see a blob. You know, where's the wavelength? Well, this is the tricky part about the square root. What's the square root of 1? That's one answer. Negative 1 is another answer, I guess, yeah. No, negative 1 is not another answer. It should be another answer. No, not, Yes, it is, I guess, another answer. So there are lots of square roots, and what we're talking about here is not so much literally what the square root is, because the psi is not going to be a real number, it's going to be a complex number. And last semester we were writing all the time things like the electric field is e to the I, you know, kx minus omega t, but that was all imaginary, as it were, right? We're only interested in the real part of it. But now we're going to think that this psi really is complex. And if we look at the real part of psi, it is, you know, going to have waves in it. And if we look at the imaginary part of psi, it's going to have waves in it. But if we look at the magnitude of psi, then it's going to have this simple shape. Okay, so to give you an example of such a function, if we had e to the minus x squared over sigma squared, that would give us a lump. And if I had then e to the I 5 times x, that would give me waves. But when I take the magnitude of this, right, if I multiply this by its complex conjugate, that term is going to go away, and I'm just going to get the lump. Okay, so even this simple idea of the square root of the probability density isn't quite true, because we're really thinking about psi being complex. And what we're really saying is that the probability density is equal to psi star psi, which is the same thing as the magnitude of psi. And the waves are typically going to be in the imaginary part. Now it's going to turn out, I think unfortunately, in kind of textbook sorts of problems, commonly psi will be real and we'll see actual waves in it. But that's kind of not the usual case. That's kind of how they work out in textbooks. But, I don't know, because that's not uncommonly the case in textbooks, sometimes people will write just psi squared. But if you see something like psi squared, it's basically always psi star psi that they're really thinking about. Okay. So given a probability density now, and again, we can find the probability density experimentally by doing that sort of thing, how would you find the average value, the standard deviation, and those sorts of things. How would you describe where this particle is? Right. So if we have a list of numbers, it's easy to find the average and the standard deviation. How is that going to work with the probability density? So what we've said is that in quantum mechanics, we're going to be spending a lot of time talking about this quantity called the wave function psi. And that approximately speaking, what the wave function is the square root of the probability density. And the probability density is something that you calculated kind of in the bubble chamber lab, right? You went from a list of numbers to kind of a histogram that showed where what were the common values and what were the uncommon values. And we've said that we could calculate the probability density from a list of numbers kind of like that. And what we're trying to do now is to figure out, given the probability density, how do we get the average value, which oddly enough we're going to call the expectation value, and how do we get some measurement of the size of this blob. And that's basically the standard deviation. And what we're looking for now is formulas that involve this quantity to give us these things. So how would we calculate the average value? I think so. So if we look at kind of the definition of what the, so we know what the average is, kind of usually we'd add up all of these locations, but instead of adding up all of these locations, we could take any particular value of x and multiply by the number of x values that are there. How many values of x were more, how many values in this list of 1,000 numbers were more or less in that spot? And then we can kind of play some games here. If I divide this by n and multiply it by n and divide this by delta x and multiply it by delta x, that's all fair game. And this quantity here, that's the probability density. And so we're going to end up with then is the integral of the probability density dx. Oops. Now, for reasons that are not at all clear to start with, I am going to write this like this, right? That psi star psi is the same thing as the probability density. And for some reason, I'm going to insist on putting the x in between psi and psi star. It obviously doesn't matter where that x goes, everything's commutative, but that's kind of how things are going to work. So actually, there we go. It makes me happier. Okay, so the expectation value, the average value, that's the integral of psi star psi. And again, this would be over all possibilities, even, I mean, once we know that psi is zero, there's no reason to actually do the integral, but there's no harm in doing the integral either. Okay, so that gives us kind of the average position of this particle. How about the standard deviation?
Yeah,
Right, so the standard deviation squared is add up how the value deviates from the average squared, and then divide it by n. So it's also useful to say that we're going to denote this like that. And although it's premature and you don't have to write this down, eventually we're going to write it like that too. So we know what the psi thing is that we're dealing with. Now, why don't I explain this notation? Even though I'm not going to be using it very commonly, we will in the end be using it frequently. So maybe now is as good as any time to describe it. And so that's what that notation means. So pays your money, takes your choice. Okay, so we can play pretty much exactly the same game if we want with this sum than we had with the other sum. Right? So we can multiply it by n, divide it by n, bring in the x, count all of the x's that are in pretty much the same bin. And so what we're going to get then is the integral of x minus the average value of x squared times rho of x. Now, if we want, we can kind of simplify this a little bit. If I expand out that square, what I'm going to get is x squared minus 2x times the average value of x plus the average value of x squared, all times rho, and then dx. Now, the average value of x, it's a number in contrast to x, which is a variable, right? So we can pull those things out and break this sum up. And we can get that. So, what's this? Say again? No. So if we think about this in terms of the original kind of sum that's there, this would be the sum of the delta n divided by n divided by delta x times delta x. And if we kind of pull things apart, we'd get something like that. What's that? So the sum is adding up the number of particles that are in this bin and that bin and this 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 bin. And this bin. What are we going to get if we do that? So the overall result is going to be 1, right? If I add up the number of particles that are in every bin, I'm going to get the total number of particles. And if I divide that by n, I'm going to get 1. So this is an important property that the total probability has to be 1. And it's an obvious property, but it turns out that it's maybe not always a convenient property. So this is called normalization. And a real common thing we're going to be doing kind of all the time is we're going to be given a function which is not equal to a probability density. It's proportional to a probability density. And we're going to want to find this overall factor. So in this case, this n doesn't stand for the number of data points. It just stands for some arbitrary overall factor. Maybe I should call it A instead so there's no confusion. And we're going to want to solve for that A. which is called normalizing the function. And the process is pretty easy, right? So if I integrate both sides of this equation, we know that the integral of the probability density is supposed to be 1. So this value of A, has to be given by that result. And another way of saying that, of course, is that the actual probability density is 1 over A, which is the integral of f of x dx times f of x. Okay, so given a function that doesn't add up to 1, we can make it add up to 1 by supplying an overall constant to it. And that process is called normalization. Okay, so that's equal to 1. What's this equal to? Say again?
That'd be like the average value.
Yep. So this thing here was rho of x dx, and that's the average value of x. So what we've got here then is this is, of course, by definition, the average of x squared. And so we've got minus 2 times the average value squared. We put those two together. And we've got this one with plus the average value of x squared. And you can see that a simpler formula for the standard deviation squared, sometimes called the variance, is the average of the x's squared minus the average of x squared. Okay, so again, what we've been thinking about is the experiment where we take using a ball, but if we're going to actually make these measurements, we would want to do it with electrons, where we take an electron and we release it, and we ask where it is after 1 second. And we start it at exactly the same position and velocity, and we ask where it is after 1 second, and it's not at exactly the same position. So we get these list of 1,000 possible locations of the particle that started with this probability density. Okay, so I don't know, that's I guess that's kinematics. So what we would expect under these circumstances is if I were to plot the position versus x at a sequence of times, right? So starts out that the particle is basically here, has average value there, and then in the future it's moved a little bit, and in the future it's moved even more. And that's, of course, what we're interested in. Not just what the probability is now, but how the probability is going to change in the future. So we need some equation for dynamics. We need to know how rho is going to change with time. And the answer looks pretty ugly, but by the end of this class, I'm going to convince you that it looks pretty nice and normal. So kind of no surprise, it's going to have I's in it because it's complex. This quantity H is Planck's constant, but almost everything in this class is going to have an H bar in it. And what H bar means is Planck's constant divided by 2 pi. So basically, Planck didn't get his constant right the first time. It'd be nice if he had divided it by 2 pi to make all of our equations look a lot nicer. Okay, so what we've got then is that if we take I times H bar and get the time derivative of psi, that's the same thing as doing the following. Oops. Okay, and it might be helpful to rewrite this the other way, that the way psi changes in time is given by 1 over I h bar minus h bar squared divided by 2m, two derivatives of psi plus v, where v is the potential energy. And of course, the potential energy contains knowledge of what the forces are. So this is the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And we're actually going to be spending more time with the time-independent Schrodinger equation, but not today. Okay, so in some sense, the process is clear, right? So if we know what the probability density, we can at least kind of take the square root of it to get what psi is, and then we can take derivatives of it and multiply it by the potential, and we can figure out how it's going to change in time. And of course, roughly what we're expecting is that we better have positive derivatives here so that we're going to build up stuff on this side, and we better have negative derivatives there so that we can get rid of stuff there. And then effectively, of course, that's going to move this wave function a little bit forward in time. And things are made extra complex by the presence of I there. And what that I says is that if psi started as real, it's soon going to be complex, right? You can't fundamentally have psi remain real for long periods of time. It's going to pick up complex quantities kind of automatically. Well, we're going to play games with this quantity that are going to seem pointless, I think, to start with. And the idea is to factor out a psi from that expression. Okay, so if I do that, and I'm just looking at this parenthesis quantity, I can write this as 2m's and then the instruction to take two derivatives with respect to x and multiply it by phi. And certainly the same thing. It's not clear that much is made out of this. And we're going to make kind of a big deal about this quantity. This is going to be called the Hamiltonian. From Hamilton. My guess is that you should have spent at least a couple of days talking about the Hamiltonian in mechanics, and you might remember that I gave you one homework problem with the Hamiltonian in E&M. It didn't play a big role in mechanics because the Lagrangian was easier, but it's going to play a big role here in quantum mechanics kind of all the time. So if I call that quantity the Hamiltonian, denote it by H, then I can write that thing as H times psi. And it's useful to kind of think about this analogously. So psi itself is a function of position, right? So psi takes real numbers into real numbers. And this Hamiltonian is something equivalent to that, but at a higher level, right? The Hamiltonian takes a function, any function, and it turns it into another function. So it's a function with a domain of functions. And it's helpful to have a name for something like that. We're going to call it an operator. And kind of the fundamental postulate of quantum mechanics is that for every physical variable that you met in mechanics, there's a corresponding operator for it. So you might remember, probably don't, might remember that the Hamiltonian was basically the energy. So we could call the Hamiltonian the energy operator, although it's not quite exactly correct. In a very simple sense, X is an operator, right? Because X takes the function F to the function X times F, which is a different function. And that's going to be, of course, the position operator. We're going to want to have a momentum operator. And it's going to turn out that the momentum operator is H bar divided by I, take the derivative with respect to x. And if you take derivative of a function, you get another function. So this is an operator. It takes a function to a function. And that's what it is. With that in mind, notice that this quantity is the operator p squared divided by 2m. Right? We take one derivative, we take another derivative, we get the second derivative. The i's are going to give us the minus sign, and we're going to get 2h bars. So in terms of an operator equation, this Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus the potential energy. And although you're probably used to thinking about the about kinetic energy as being 1 half mv squared, it's also p squared over 2m. So as an operator equation, this is telling us that the energy is the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. Okay, so our game is going to be to find these operators and, you know, figure out how these blobs seem to move through time. But more commonly, we're going to be interested in the equivalent of standing waves. So it turns out that for normal sort of motions, an electron near a nucleus, the typical time scale is a nanosecond. So things are either going to change on a nanosecond time scale and they're going to be radically different, or we're going to reach some sort of steady situation. And since, you know, humans don't kind of live on a nanosecond situation, anything that we actually observe is going to be a standing wave. So we're going to be interested in standing waves of probability around particles. And that's going to be the basis of this time-independent Schrodinger equation, where we're not looking at blobs that are moving, but we're looking at standing waves. Now, having said the word standing waves, I'm sure this is all obvious, but standing waves don't actually stand, right? If we look at this piece, in the future, it's going to look like that. Going to look like that. So there is motion, but there's motion within a kind of standardized pattern, right? So a standing wave, for example, could be described as something that's sinusoidal in x and something that's sinusoidal in time. And it's going to work the same way for these standing waves, which are also called stationary states, but I remind you they're not actually stationary. It's just that they have time variation that puts things within that sort of situation. Okay, So I think that's all they give me. Questions? So there are three problems from chapter one. So read chapter one and we'll, we've got a little bit more of chapter one to do. Well, actually, we got probably half of chapter one to do, but.
It started at 8:59 today. It's a compressed schedule.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, the usual slash different.
So.
15 minutes from now. So they're 40-minute classes with 15-minute breaks.